My family had a European adventure right after I finished school, and our first stop landed us in Italy. One does not simply visit Italy without visiting the Vatican, and therein, one does not simply visit the Vatican without visiting the Sistine Chapel. Meandering through the Vatican Museum, when I finally reached the middle of the ornate chapel, our tour guide pointed skywards. It was overwhelming, to say the least. The entire ceiling was too much to take in all at once. Consisting of individual panels of highly decorated paintings, it takes a minute or several for your eyes to focus on any individual work when the whole ceiling, nay, the whole room can be looked at as a singular work of art, parts that form a greater whole. But scouring through the faded tones of Renaissance masters, I finally found something that I could name, and so could you, without any knowledge of art, history, or even art history. I had before me Michelangelo's Creation of Adam. It is no exaggeration to say that it is the most recognizable work of art in the world, perhaps eclipsed only by the Mona Lisa, the most famous painting to come out of the Renaissance. The motif of the finger of God reaching out to the hand of man has been reproduced to death, painted on the back pockets of jeans, graffitied over suburban public spaces, or copied over pendants and delicate necklaces. My 15-year-old self was able to recognize it, name it even, despite having no interest in Renaissance, art or otherwise. Don't let pictures you see online or even your eyes deceive you. The painting is massive, over 9 feet in height and more than 18 feet in width. But you cannot gauge the scale by a cursory glance. For shortening dictates, objects at a distance look smaller. It is how people can conflate a bird, a plane and a Superman. Unlike other works exhibited on museum walls, you can't go as close as the museum guard would allow. It is to be enjoyed at a distance of 60 feet, maybe less, if you're taller. Commentators often say Mona Lisa is nothing special and unworthy of her fame. I would like to counter that at least it is at eye level and not a pain in the neck to observe. Michelangelo himself had many physical discomforts painting the ceiling. It is definitely an example of human excellence, yet it is hard to gauge why that specific piece has garnered so much traction, as it is surrounded by equally impressive frescoes created in the same style with the same dedication. Maybe it's the message more so than the execution, the braille-like shape holding the angels, the prone form of Adam, and the finger of God reaching out. The variety of interpretations it has espoused speaks to the universality of art to live beyond the scope of the creator's intent. It is a deeply religious image. In the most sacred space of the Catholic Church, the future of the faith is decided within those chapel walls. These are the chambers where the College of Cardinals cast from amongst themselves a new leader of the Church when the previous Pope dies, or as was the case recently, steps down. The Sistine Chapel is not only a tourist attraction, it is the living heart of the largest Christian denomination, a site of great pilgrimage. Despite this context about the location and the contents of image, the creation of Adam, specifically the motif of a hand reaching out to another, has been co-opted in many secular settings. The divinity of the image is dropped in preference for its aesthetic appreciation. Sure, not everyone evoking the composition does so devoid of its theological implications, yet a vast majority do. As the image gets circulated and reproduced, it invites parodies and copies, which themselves invite more copies. Somewhere along this flow, the original intent is lost, and it reaches consumers like the old me, who knew nothing of the image or its origins except its name and composition. Ethan Zuckerman, director of MIT Center for Civic Media, writes of the white plastic chair design called the monoblock, found seemingly everywhere around the world, coining it as a context-free object. He says, virtually every object suggests a time and place. The shape of electrical outlets, labels on any consumer products, fabrics, clothing, are all close to whether a photo was taken in the 1970s or last week, in Sydney or Schenectady. The monoblock is one of the few objects I can think of that is free of any context. Seeing a white plastic chair in a photograph offers you no clue about where or when you are. The images of the chair have certainly unearthed some deep childhood memories for me. For all I know, you could be sitting in one right now, listening to the podcast. The point is, the design of the chair has become so universally known, it is hard to fit it in a time and place. A Vice reporter interviewing Zuckerman says in regards to being context-free, to me, the lack of context in the monologue is inherently disturbing. The creation of Adam does not fit into this definition put forth by Zuckerman. Even those with the bare-bones knowledge of history can recognize the opulent, realistic Renaissance style. Unlike a chair, there is a clear source of origin for the reproduction of the painting. But despite barriers of being deeply religious, being fixed on the ceiling, thereby allowing it to be enjoyed by only those who were physically able to go to the Vatican up until recently, and belonging to a very specific time period, the multitudes of its reproduction indicate a universality of its design and appearance. It represents any idea or image with enough popularity, loses some context, and is transmitted less on its inherent attributes like form and reason, and more on the fact that others know it and reference it. It is context-free enough that just a picture of a finger reaching out to a hand represents the whole. Location is tremendously important, particularly to murals and frescoes, the kind that are built into the structure. Art built into the walls of a structure can be viewed as part of the larger art that is the structure itself, though that is a conversation for another time. But here I was, stumped like the rest of the students in my first year history class when we were asked to identify and locate a painting of 13 men dining on a large table. Most, including me, having unfortunately read the Da Vinci Code, rightly guessed it as the Last Supper. But what stumped our entire class of over 100 history students was the fact that nobody could guess its location. Some vague attempts were made of Italy or Rome, but no one actually knew it was a mural in the dining room at the convent of Santa Maria della Grazia in Milan. If you knew then, congratulations, you have won at history. But if you didn't, welcome to the club of all my friends I asked this question to, many of them history majors and enthusiasts, but none knew. These experiences of knowing things without their context are not only limited to art. These experiences of knowing things without their context are not only limited to art. You must have heard of Mr. Schrödinger and his poor cat who may be dead or alive, or Mr. Paolo and his hungry dog. These experiments, real or theorized, have evolved from their roots in quantum theory and psychology respectively, and have found new life in pop science references on history podcasts. But you may ask, why bother with context when art can and should be enjoyed on the merits of aesthetic, form, style and technique? Let art be for art's sake, you would say. Well, A. Because aesthetical taste is not as individually defined as we would like it to be. It is part of the cultural zeitgeist and is defined largely by society elites. The age-old debate of what constitutes capital A art and can therefore be enjoyed by society by fulfilling all the need art meets is not decided by an individual. Art as an objective idea does not exist in the same realm as mountains, shoes or democracies, something well defined and definite. But even if that is not a problem for you, because most everything is defined by these so-called society elites or experts, consider this. B. A lot of art is appreciated because of its perceived artistic or aesthetic value. But that is bollocks, because art is created in a context, and most of the time when we view art in galleries, museums or over a screen, the context is lost, plain and simple. The hedonistic view of art as virtuous by merely its artistic merit erases its historic precedent. You can't go to a weapons exhibit and call Bronze Age iron tools inelegant, crude and distasteful despite the fact that they do look kind of wonky. You would ideally understand, in order to progress, you ought to start somewhere, and these early attempts, despite being far from sophisticated, were important in the creation of later Iron Age tools. Even within the traditional notion of art history, stylistic choices were less for aesthetic appeal and more oriented towards historic precedent. Medieval Christian art is frankly notorious for this, with their highly stylized take on children. But it is an artistic choice and not an accident. If you don't know what I'm talking about, I could explain the images of these children to you. But it would rob you of the joy of googling them to see it for yourself. You do not want to miss the chance to see baby Jesus with male pattern baldness and a six-pack ab. Would recommend 11 on 10. The reason for this divorce between art and context is because it is more tempting to look at the contents of a piece rather than its value as usually a sacred object. It doesn't help that our modern perceptions of art are biased towards its visual appeal rather than pure function, which was the way throughout history. Art for art's sake is a modern idea. Art was meant to educate, inform, and be prayed to. aesthetics were secondary or max to max complementary to the function of art. And most importantly, C. Divorcing aesthetics from context also leads to the more serious problem of appropriation, because believe it or not, the aesthetics of art that is highly symbolic are created in highly specific socio-religious contexts. In the Victoria's Secret 2017 Shanghai show, multiple models walked down the runway in animal print bikinis adorning Native American headdresses along with beaded jewelry. The war bonnet, the first visual association most people have with Native American culture, has long been used to represent Indians, from questionable sports team mascots to many appearances in Hollywood westerns. But here is the thing, the feathered war bonnet is worn only by the high-ranking members of certain tribes of Native Americans. Each tribe has a different style in the material used in the bonnet. The association of all Native Americans adorning the headdress is a caricature meant to generalize and homogenize the separate identity of their tribes. This is far from the most egregious example of its usage as a fashion accessory without context to its ritualistic purpose. But the prevalence of such a trope suggests a popularity of the practice of art appreciation without context, ultimately leading to appropriation. Co-opting the aesthetics of religious or cultural symbols, removing their historic identity in the process is, how should I say, not a good look. Specifically, when those co-opting happen to be of a greater political power, symbols used correctly or incorrectly that are projected onto a group to other them as distinct, primitive or exotic, and then their aesthetic is stolen, inspired to sell bikinis or whatever else, further damages the cultural identities of these groups. And to an extent, art allows you to do so because the conventional view of art for art's sake. Religious and cultural artifacts cannot subscribe to the idea of appreciation regardless of context, especially those religious and cultural traditions that are practiced today. If you do, you get images of Hindu gods and flip-flops. To a religion obsessed with purity, shoes are not even allowed inside your house, much less a temple. The sheer offense of having your feet touch the image of God cannot even be articulated. To call an artifact art is to bestow upon its usually anonymous creator with artistic merit, but on its way it delegitimizes the it delegitimizes the cultural and religious context it emerges from. Part 1. Defining art. I'm not going to. I would rather shoot myself in the foot than dabble in the debate that has stretched on from time immemorial. It is somehow considered controversial to oversee what can and cannot be called art. So instead of affixing a definition for what is art, I would like to propose what art is. Not a means of identifying what is and is not art, but an overline of what can be found within art. There are two sides, the form and style that creates its aesthetic and the meaning that is meant to be derived from the work. These two parts come together to form art greater than either could individually. For the purposes of this episode, however, as you may have noticed, there's a lot of conflation of art, visual appeal, religious and cultural symbolism. Modernity finds these terms to be distinct. However, throughout history, the role art played in all aspects was vastly different. Function triumphed over all considerations. To an extent, even today, when art is used for tax evasion, the function has triumphed over its artistic merit. But we don't talk about corruption and shady industry practices of the current art market. With very few exceptions, throughout history, art has either been used to depict divinity or for public education. Even the purposes of cave art is hotly debated. It could be part of a proto-religious animism, or a visual encyclopedia for future generations of what and how to hunt. Or it could be both. Man, cave art is found all over the world and belongs to a massively huge time period of over 40,000 years. And that's a conservative estimate. It is hard for us to tell if cave art was merely decorative, because leisure is rarely the focus of serious historic inquisition. It is hard to tell anything in general about prehistory, but consider this. Humans of the time had the same cognitive abilities as humans of now. And people are hardwired to appreciate beauty. Plus, they usually like their living quarters to be at least presentable, least some uninvited guest shows up despite it being the middle of a pandemic and people don't want to leave their own homes, much less come to ours. Mom! I digress. Maybe some cave art is simply wall texture and we have been overanalyzing it. But largely, there was little freedom throughout history about what artists could make. First and most importantly, they were limited by commissions, by either royalty or the religious order. The artist had no individual identity. They were part of the collective that took orders and executed art. It was always the societal elites who decided what art should be. That is why temples and palaces are the most ornate, overdone buildings in any empire. They were the ones with the cash. Secondly, cultural traditions limit what an artist could and couldn't draw in the first place. Islam had rigid rules of what can and cannot be depicted through realism. Art was expressed through geometry and calligraphy. While secular art existed, there were clearly religious undertones that forbade idolatry. In the Christian tradition, art was a manifestation of divinity and therefore the subject had to be divine. Thirdly, individuality is a modern construct. Art wasn't attributed to an individual artist. There was no ownership of its creation. That allowed for little experimentation with style and form. Art evolved gradually through collective technique. Art today serves many functions, but least of all it is expected to be decorative. However, many modern movements are moving away from this perceived aesthetical value. I told you I was not going to define art, but I will let you in on my favorite definition of it. Noted Hollywood actor and cannibal Shia LaBeouf, when asked if memes were art, said these magical words. Art is anything that moves you. And that is right and true. The modern function of art is to make you feel. The way we approach art is different from our forebearers, but as gradual changes in perceptions go, I would say we are in a relatively good place with the purpose of art within our lives. Part 2. Defining tastes. Devil Wears Prada, the movie based on the book of the same name, is the story of a tyrannical fashion lady who bullies her new assistant into being cool. Miranda Priestly, the editor-in-chief of fashion magazine Runway, is helping put together an outfit for a photo shoot when her new assistant Andy, who is new to the world of fashion, in an unfashionably bulky blue sweater, lets out a laugh at the vanity of the process. Her boss unleashes a thunderstorm onto her. You go to your closet and you select, I don't know, that lumpy blue sweater, for instance, because you're trying to tell the world that you take yourself too seriously to care about what you put on your back. But what you don't know is that sweater is not just blue. It's not turquoise, it's not lapis, it's cerulean. And you're so blithely unaware of the fact that in 2002, Oscar de la Renta did a collection of cerulean gowns. And then cerulean quickly showed up in the collections of 8 different designers. And it then filtered down through the department stores and trickled down onto some casual corner where you, no doubt, fished it out of some clearance bin. However, that blue represents millions of dollars and countless jobs, and it's sort of comical how you think that you made a choice that exempts you from the fashion industry, when in fact you're wearing the sweater that was selected for you by the people in this room from a pile of stuff. What Priestley so expertly describes here is the trickle-down theory of fashion, the oldest in fashion consumption and distribution. The hierarchical societal elite set the status quo for a style that trickles downwards from haute couture runways to fast fashion. The everyday consumer then unknowingly models themselves after the elites, flock to the styles that eventually become so commonplace that the elites have to move to another style, which in turn trickles down as well. These societal elites have changed over time, as methods of production and modes of promoting influence have shifted. But the model still remains viable for an internet age which has democratized the membership of the circles of promoting influence. Today, we look at the carefully curated feeds of Instagram celebrities for the latest in fashion trends. Before, it was royalty and nobility that set the trends. In 1840, Queen Victoria, in her wedding to Prince Albert, chose to wear a white dress. Although not the first royal to wear white on a wedding day, she certainly was the most influential, as she set the tradition for the bride's white dress in a Christian wedding. Until then, women wore whatever decent clothes they had because, get this, clothes were expensive, fabric was expensive, tailoring was expensive. having a dedicated white dress that one could not repurpose later for fear of getting it stained, gave rise to a new breed of hyper-specialized clothing. This was conspicuous consumption at its best. The need to flaunt one's own wealth of owning a hugely expensive dress meant to be worn only on a single day. Not only the nobles, but soon the peasantry followed suit. Pre-industrial revolution, owning multiples of anything was a luxury. Attitude towards clothing have rapidly shifted with the reduction of cost and, most would argue, quality. Meanwhile, the white dress remains so ingrained in culture, it seems almost an act of rebellion when a woman chooses to wear a non-white color at her wedding. The white dress is as much a symbol of purity as it is of historic access to wealth. For a tradition set in stone so relatively recently, it has supplanted itself quite firmly in the common conscience through the many surrounding informal rules that offer it a greater legitimacy. Only the bride can wear white on the wedding day. She needs to spend an obscene amount of money on it, and she should hold on to the dress to pass it down to her daughter. It is encouraged, nay, it's expected of little girls to dream of their white dress. The downward trickle of fashion reflects the class divide throughout history. Fashion is born out of the sensibilities of the time, its religious beliefs, aesthetical considerations, climate and etiquette, but more importantly, access your socio-economic position provides. Take the hanbok, for example, the traditional clothing of the Korean people. The hanbok, meaning Korean clothing, emerged as a terminology to distinguish itself from the Western clothing called yangbok. So the term hanbok is general in the sense that it refers to most of the pre-modern clothing worn in Korea, and also specific as it has mostly maintained the same form and silhouette over the years with several stylistic changes. It consists of two parts, the upper garment jogri and the lower flared skirt called chima for women and a pant called baji for men. As eras change and political power shift, alterations in the length of the jogri and the volume of the chima have been the distinguishing factors between the time periods. The Joseon dynasty, which lasted from the end of the 14th century to the end of the 19th century, saw the most dramatic transformation of the garment. Society during this period was well regimented, with four different classes of people: the aristocrats, the middle class, the commoners, and the lower class. In the late Joseon period, the loose jogri was tightened to be more form-fitting. To call everyone's clothing hanbok is correct yet imprecise, since it is a contemporary term used to describe the clothing of an entire peninsula. Even within the time period, there are a lot of stylistic differences in the kind of clothes worn by these different classes. There are strict social norms about the style and color different classes could wear, with more bright and vibrant colors reserved for royalty. Fashion was functional, yes, but also performative of an individual's role within society. Very much like art throughout history, there are always limitations placed on what can and cannot be depicted. Sometimes it was overt, but more often it was covert. Curation and exhibition of art was limited not only to the art itself, but the class and gender of the artist. The arbiters of post-Renaissance European paintings were these mega-powerful art exhibitors of the Paris Salon. Their curated art fair set the tone for what was in season, which art deserved recognition and patronage. They were the drivers of the art market of the era. It was incredibly prestigious to be part of their selection. But the entry to be showcased in the salon was highly guarded, where more traditional, detailed and realistic styles were lauded and fetched high prices from collectors. They created a feedback loop, for what was in public taste was exhibited in the salon, and what the salon exhibited became the public taste. Experimentation and evolution were not given a mainstream audience. Those rejected by the salon cried foul, so much so that a separate salon was set for their paintings in an effort to demonstrate the process of selection for the real salon was democratic. This salon was attended by many, most did so ironically to ridicule the rejected art. Nonetheless, it opened the floodgates of what art the public could receive. Based on this success, the independent artists of France began exhibiting their work outside the rigidity set by the salon. They became known as the Impressionist Exhibitions, and who we study today as the founders of Impressionism, Monet, Renoir, Pissarro, Degas, all showcased their works here. The term Impressionism was very much used in an insult to mock the crude new style, yet eventually the term was embraced by these artists, and the rest, as they say, is history. Modern art was born out of this revolt. It is the breakup from the mainstream and paved the way for future experimentation within art. The avant-garde was born in the salon of the rejects. This goes to show that the elite theory is not absolute, especially within the realm of art. These elusive beings at the apex of the social hierarchy are hugely influential in all matters of affairs, but at times, opinions of the masses supplant their authority. This happens in two ways: when there's a deliberate attempt to reach out and be more inclusive to a wider range of talents from the outgroup, or when the sensibilities of the majority come barreling down over the elites, where their only option is to conform and adopt or forfeit their position of influence. The former seems to be rarer than the latter. Conforming and adopting has the added benefit of co-opting the tastes of the masses for profit. It certainly does not help that there is a division between high art and low art. High art is seen as the enjoyment of the classics, those associated with antiquity. The upper echelons of these art markets are plagued with elitism to the highest degree. The art has a rigid, Puritan undertone that will resist intermingling with newer, more experimental styles. Jazz funk or street jazz, for example, is a dance style rooted in hip-hop, jazz and whacking, but has a lot of influences from ballet. Ballet is part of the larger tradition of classics, once upon a time reserved only for those of a certain fair complexion. Jazz funk grew out of a frustration for African-American dancers not being allowed to learn and practice ballet. While jazz funk borrows postures and positions from ballet to combine it with jazz, hip-lay combines the fluidity and energy of hip-hop with the point technique from ballet. It is an unabashed rehash of the most difficult techniques of ballet, and its dancers are those who did not find acceptance within pure ballet. Carnatic music, emerging from the southern states, like many social institutions in contemporary India, has the shadow of the caste system looming large over it. The largest annual event for Carnatic music is the Chennai music season, taking place over the winter months. T.M. Krishna, a prominent musician and activist, had a very public uncoupling with the festival because of what he perceived to be a lack of diversity of artists who perform. Carnatic music is dominated by Brahmin artists, especially within Chennai, despite the fact that it does not requisite membership to a high caste. Many of the gatherings for performances called sabhas are invite-only as well as being very expensive. Experimentation and use of vernacular language are looked down upon, lest it be more accessible. When Luther translated the Bible and Dhyaneshwar translated the Gita, their hope was to break the hold of the clergy by democratizing the religious texts by making the public understand them in a language that they can read. Krishna belongs to a new school of thought within the rigid clutches of classical music, adopting its form and style but deliberately setting aside its modern history to allow for more diverse performances by including new, more accessible languages and devotional songs from outside Hinduism. His deliberate effort to bring in more diverse audiences from underprivileged sections of the society, which the elites of the sabhas have turned away, have garnered him much love as well as controversy. He has been berated in the media for politicizing music and art. But here's the thing. Power dynamics that dictate who can produce art or even who can consume it make it political. Tastes are hardly our own. They come from institutions we subscribe to. Part 3. Defining context. What is context within the understanding of art anyway? It is the conditions that led to the creation of a work or a style, wherein, upon examining these conditions, the appreciation of art can be enhanced. All this sounds rather academic, but to put it simply, context is how the art came to be. See, it doesn't come near the aesthetic meaning dichotomy I had set up myself in defining art. Art can exist without context. More often than not, it does. Think about all the objects that surround you, the door, the chair, the table, what have you. They were all designed by somebody. At one stage of the production of design, even if it was a mass market commodity created in huge numbers at overseas factories, someone looked at the drawing on a paper, decided it was art, and sent it off to production. Most everything has a context of how it came to be, and you will go insane, or worse, old, before you can reach a satisfiable conclusion of the context of half the things in your life. But apart from the very real fears of appropriation when context cues are lost, knowing the history of things is just kinda neat. It improves your appreciation of the world. We live in the contours of an industrial society surrounded by more things than we could ever hope to imagine in their absence. the detachment that comes from owning items produced so far away from your person through a highly streamlined industrial complex makes you devalue items. A few hundred years ago, mechanized items were more elusive because they came with a perception of being precise and advanced. Now, handmade items are better valued because they tap into the accomplishment of being able to survive mechanization. Marx spoke of his theory of alienation as the detachment of the worker from the final product because capitalism has assigned everybody such specific tasks that one person can claim ownership of the result. The consumer feels this too, with no attribution to a person or a cause. But art has had an opposite trajectory, from collectivized anonymity to individualized specificity. The more and more we see art that reflects the creator or their values, the more we are drawn to it. That, I think, is one of the major successes of modern art, where individual narrative triumphs form and style. As art emerges meaning first, form second, they both must work cohesively to form a bigger picture. The absence of such cohesion causes a substantive dissonance, which at times can be a deconstructive approach by the artist to further illustrate the point. Hannah Gadsby, in her breakout hit comedy special, Nanette, tears down the whole ethos of observational comedy, particularly the kind that relies on making light of one's own critical life experiences. Nanette chronicles Gadsby's story of coming out of the closet in a deeply homophobic community and how she dealt with it as a comedian. She says, "What I had done with the comedy show about coming out was I froze an incredibly formative experience at its trauma point and sealed it off into jokes. That story became routine, and through repetition, that joke was fused with my actual memory of what happened. But unfortunately, that joke version was not nearly sophisticated enough to help me undo the damage done to me in reality." Nanette is a meta-commentary on the dated format of the comedy special, and what better way to do it than through a comedy special itself. Aesthetics allude to an intended meaning, but context within art is separate from these considerations. Context is history-based, while meaning needn't be. The artist could do their very best to keep the work open to interpretation, a la naming the work Untitled, yet there will always be a context. For example, look at Untitled Imperfect Lovers by Felix Gonzalez Torres, a Cuban-American minimalist. It's two standard industrial clocks hung on a wall next to each other, starting at the same time. The corresponding wall tag at the Metropolitan Museum of Modern Art, New York, reads, "Initially set to the same time, these identical battery-powered clocks will eventually fall out of sync or may stop entirely." Conceived shortly after Gonzalez Torres' partner was diagnosed with AIDS, this work uses everyday objects to track and measure the inevitable flow of time. When one of the clocks stops or breaks, they can both be reset, thereby resuming perfect synchrony. In 1991, Gonzalez Torres reflected, "Time is something that scares me, or used to. This piece I made with two clocks was the scariest thing I had ever done. I wanted to face it. I wanted those clocks right in front of me, ticking." The minimalist tried to abstract complex ideas into very bare essentials of what they would require conveying. These two clocks spoke of time, of two lovers suspended in time, slaving away at it. The hands of those two clocks would always move forward, but their inevitable conclusion was the fact that they would stop. Gonzalez Torres was a gay artist working in the height of the AIDS crisis. AIDS was initially called the gay-related immune deficiency, or GRID. It was considered by many a consequence of a gay lifestyle. Homosexuality and the syndrome were linked from its initial discovery. The leap from gay men getting a deadly virus to divine retribution for a sinful lifestyle was not very far off. Data that AIDS could affect everybody, not just homosexuals, was publicly ignored to further marginalize them. Protest after protest demanded the public health infrastructure pay attention to them. At the same time, there was a very public debate happening over censorship in art. National Endowment Funds for the Arts, a federal body in America that funds art, came under scrutiny for its funding of Andreas Cinaro's Piss Jesus, a picture of a crucifix submerged in urine. It was deemed blasphemous by conservative religious groups, and many senators condemned the NEA for being anti-Christian. The exhibition of photographs of Robert Mapplethorpe, a prominent LGBTQ photographer who had recently died of AIDS, was caught in the backlash of the attack on the arts. The exhibition, The Perfect Moment, which included, among many other things, homoerotic imagery, was meant to be a celebration of Mapplethorpe's works. However, the NEA faced much greater pushback this time for its funding of the exhibition. Many works by HIV-positive artists were questioned during this period in America from 1989 to 1991. Untitled Perfect Lovers managed to escape the scrutiny, perhaps highlighting the kind of art society gave permission to LGBTQ artists to demonstrate their grievances. An abstract image of two clocks on the wall could signal a disease and loss, at a time when more and more art was getting questioned. Gonzalez Torres claimed he did not produce gay art, but many of his works drew from his identity as a gay artist during a time when homosexuality and the institution of arts were both facing a threat. The conclusion of Perfect Lovers is a tragic one. Ross Laycock passed away in 1991, followed by his partner Felix Gonzalez Torres in 1996, both from AIDS. In a letter to his lover 2 years before his death, Torres writes, "Don't be afraid of clocks. They are our time. The time has been so generous to us. We conquered fate by meeting at a certain time in a certain space. We are synchronized. Now, forever. I love you." Like sitting through the movie as the end credits roll, understanding the context of art is the least we can do to show our appreciation to the artist. Gestalt History is written, produced, and narrated by me, Gayatri. This is part one of a two-part series on art and context. Subscribe to the podcast, now available on any major podcast hosting website and app to never miss an episode.